is sort of like a continuation of the best matching stuff, but it's a different way of looking at temporal relationalism. So it's a new proposal. The way that we first saw how to implement temporal relationalism was just with this Jacobi's principle, which is a really nice sort of action principle. But turns out there's another way to do it that's equivalent, that's based on best matching. And the interesting thing is that in Barbara Bertotti's derivation theorem of general relativity, they have this they get this BSW form of the GR action, which is not really a very common way of change in relativity. But if you do the gravity theory using this thing, I'm about to show you, you get the ADM action, which is a much more stable form. So it doesn't have all the square roots, and that's maybe nice mathematically. So conceptually, you don't have the same nice things like you're trying to find a metric on configuration space. But mathematically, it's a lot cleaner because you don't have to deal with square roots. So I'll start with talking about that, and then we'll do a little warm up with how to do best matching on a field theory. So that should get us ready for GR. Okay. So this is, I call it gauging time. I don't know if it's really the right word, but it sounds nice. It's on the archive if you're interested. Actually, I'll be updating this soon with the version that's going to go in classical quantum mechanics. It might be a little bit better, the version that's on the archive. So the idea is we start with this action that we looked at sort of a couple weeks ago, which is just Newtonian mechanics, but where you promote time to the dynamical variable. So the action, you remember, looked like this. And so Q naught was, so it was defined on extended configuration space. So this configuration space is of the particle positions, but also this Q-naught variable, which is supposed to be, which is equivalent to the Newtonian time on shell. So you get equations of motion for the Q-naught, they want to be equivalent to Newtonian. When you quantize this theory, you get a time-dependent Schrodinger equation, because this guy has a canonically conjugate variable P naught that gets promoted to an operator that turns into a dynamic T, which is something you don't have. So now what we're going to do is we're going to apply the same technique of best matching onto this Q naught variable. Because if you notice, this action is invariant under translations in time. So what you can do is you can say, all right, I'm going to define corrected coordinates that look like Q naught goes to Q naught plus some variable A, which is a translation. And then I'll make A time dependent. So in our prescription, what that tells us is that we're going to get a all the derivatives with respect to lambda go to the new covariant derivative of lambda, which is now also going to depend on A. And that just looks like plus A. The way that we saw it before was omega alpha T alpha or T alpha. But this guy is now the generator of time translation, so it's a diabiotic or diabiotic Q naught. And we're calling the parameter just A, so it's like this. So this is actually, this is going to be back here. This is going to be fairly easy to implement. So if we just plug that into our action, we have the time gauged parameterized particle mechanics action, which looks like T over Q naught dot plus A dot. And then what we're going to do is we're just going to do a variation with respect to the A. But it's going to be a free endpoint variation. So it's going to be a variation where we keep A fixed, A free of the endpoints. And you see what that's going to do is basically it just gives us a new time variable, right? It's a redefinition of the derivative. And what happens is because A is free of the endpoints, this new sort of effective variable is also going to be free to specify the endpoints. So if we ever try to put boundary conditions on the QNOT, these A guys are going to just wipe out whatever boundary conditions we put in. And it's going to set up boundary conditions such that the ambient is going to be zero. So that's what's going to happen. That's what the free endpoint condition is actually doing. So it's kind of a nice way to, in this very simple case, you can really see what the best matching is.
So I don't understand what the idea of doing this by doing the variation with respect to the A. It's as if you were imposing to do it to vary. There's no difference by doing the variation with respect to the A than by doing it with respect to the not, right?
But the difference is that you can see in this case that what we can really just do is replace this by a separate variable that we call whatever, and then just do a free endpoint variation with respect to that, and then that'll give us an equivalent.
Yeah.
But we could do that. But in the more complicated situations of best matching, this guy could be a non-commutative variable on a generator or something. And it's not as easy to see as we can do. But in this case, you're right. And in fact, if you treat it that way, then you really get, in general relativity, you really get the ADM action right away. But what I'm going to do is I'm just going to sort of treat this exactly the same as treating all the other guys. And it's going to be very, very simple, but the point is that you'll see we'll get a time-independent quantum theory of this. And classically, it'll be equivalent to Jacobi's theory. So if we define our momenta, it's very straightforward, right? The momenta conjugate to the Q, they're just the same as like the moments that we had before, right? This, except for you get this factor of 1 over the time, the new time variable outside. So this is it's like that I over. And there's. That's not different from what we had before. The only difference is this A piece here. Now the P naught looks very similar as well because it's just L by Q dot, and that's minus T over. You know, dot is A dot squared minus B. And but the new momentum that we have is this guy. It's di L and di A dot. And you can see it's just going to be identical to this, right? Because basically these two are the same variables. Almost the same. So right away we get some constraints. They're simple constraints, but they're analogous to the constraints we saw in BP, right? The linear constraint here, we used to call these the L. Well, L naught is just going to be that P naught is equal to pi. So it's pi naught minus P naught equals 0. And this is the thing that's analogous to the L alpha, pi alpha minus some over I, right? You can can see that if you just plug in the time generator for this and Q naught, you get exactly. So it's completely expected that we get some sort of linear constraint like this. We also have to impose the Mach constraint, I equals zero, and that is for the free endpoint variation. So this is to impose the free endpoint variation. And then on top of that, we also have the Hamiltonian constraint, which is always there for a pretty simple theories. And that's just if you take this guy and you square it, you sum over all I, and you get the kinetic energy. But you're going to pick up a piece that is this guy, 1 over this guy squared, which is really nice because that will cancel if I add P naught and B. So if I take, so if I add B and then add P naught, this whole thing is going to get 0. This is the usual Hamiltonian constraint. And remember, earlier, this is the reason why we had a time dependent Schrodinger equation, because this guy got promoted to an operator and we quantized. But now, because of these constraints, that operator is constrained to be equal to 0. So in quantum theory, see that these all turn into operator constraints in the wave function. So you have I naught on this guy, and P naught on this guy, with the same operator, and they have the same eigenvalues, and then this guy kills the wave function. So when you write this guy, you get the time independent Schrodinger equation. So again, it's implemented in spatial relationals. We can do a couple more things. I mean, we can check to see that this Pavlikovskal theory is also equivalent to the Jacobian theory. And that's, it's not hard. It might be worth doing. You can check that the... So if we look at the classical theory, we have the new Poisson brackets between the A's and the pi's. So we can double check that the new constraints actually commute, because there's no A's basically in all these constraints are in terms of the the momentum, except for this term here. So, but luckily the Hamiltonian constraint can use itself. So all the constraints are just going to commute with themselves, because there's no A for this guy to have a non-zero Poisson bracket. So this guy is 0. This guy is going to be 0 as well. And then this guy with Hamiltonian is also 0. So we have a first class system, which is good, because now we can write down Hamiltonian. The canonical Hamiltonian, as always, is going to be 0. And this new term doesn't change that. So we have this piece. We have this new piece now, the Hamiltonian, but because the action is different, this is still going to be 0, and you can check that. the reason this new term here is going to give you a piece that looks like this. But because in your Hamiltonian, because in your Lagrangian, you have this piece here and this piece here with the new A and the new T. That's going to cancel this piece and this piece together. So sure enough, it's zero. Now this is why I wanted to go through the classical theory, because you can kind of see, again, because this is just a simple thing, you can actually see what the best matching is doing. If we work out the QI's equations of motion for these guys, we're not going to get anything different because we have the same Poisson brackets and the Hamiltonian constraint is completely unchanged. So this is the only constraint that has P's and Q's in it. So, and this constraint is completely unchanged from what it was before. So let me write down Hamiltonian just to have it. Hamiltonian is Lagrange multiplier times a Hamiltonian constraint. N naught times linear constraint, and then M naught times the Mach constraint. So what you're going to get when you do this variation is you're just going to get Newton's laws the same way we had before, but with the time replaced by the lattice, this pen. So this guy was just Newton's laws with N. The Newtonian time, the ephemeris time. So the time variable is just basically n times d lambda is equal to this d Newtonian. Yes. Do you
want
me to do it?
No. It's just that you just like a few seconds ago, you call this best matching, but what do you call best matching if you don't have the omega?
Well, the A is the omega, right? So the way that, it's just a simplified version. Like, you have omega alpha T alpha, but I called sort of, there's only one generator, so I call that generator, I could call it omega naught, and then it'd be a di by di Q naught, right? But then,
so because physically the best matching was you tried to rotate it in this specific
way. Yeah, that's right.
So what is it physically now? Why is it
so now? It's a little bit. Now you probably shouldn't call it best matching. And actually, in the paper I'm a bit more careful. I call it a corrected coordinate method. So this would be a general procedure for trying to eliminate a particular symmetry. So you gauge symmetry. That's what we're doing. And you're right. It's harder to understand what you're physically doing, right? Because in the best matching, you're taking configurations and you're moving them. Now, what you're doing is you're taking the configuration, you're sort of stepping them up and down in time. You're treating time like configurations is variable, but the interpretation is very different. So it's not really clear that maybe it shouldn't be called best matching. It should just be called the corrected coordinate method, which is a mathematical procedure inspired by best matching. But you can see that it's really doing, accomplishing the same goal. You're right, and this when you multiply it by like naught, just gives omega naught, and that's what I call A. Right, so here we have Newton's laws with this N guy. But the interesting guys, the new guys, are the equations of motion of Q naught. So you have Q naught with the total Hamiltonian. And you can see that the Q naught will commute will only not commute with the P naught. So the only terms with P naughts in them are here and on Hamiltonian constraint. Okay. Hamiltonian constraint right here. So you wind up picking up n minus n naught. So you have a lapse here, which is the kind of related to the derivative of the time. And then you have this N naught, which is a new sort of gauge degree of freedom. So basically, okay, well, let me keep going. Now the equation of motion for the A dot is A until N is 20. And again, there's only two occurrences of pi's here and here. So you get N dot plus an N naught. So what you can do is you can write Q dot dot plus A dot, which is the quantity that we're seeing all the time, just as when you add these two things together and this guy drops out, so you get capital N plus M dot. So if we did this without the best matching, we would just have an N here, and that would be interpreted as the time. But now we have this extra arbitrary parameter, which is essentially saying that this thing is just a pure gauge. It's just a completely arbitrary parameter. And we can see the effect of that. That's going to have in a second. Because we can also work out the equations of motion for the momentum, which are a trivial option because there's no Q dots in any of the constraints. So this is just equal to zero. And the same thing with the pi dots. But the one I want to show is this guy here. Because what it says is that we have conserved quantities, that the P naught is a constant. And this is the thing that we call the negative of the total energy. So now what you can do is you can take this Hamiltonian constraint on shell and you can solve for n. And you get the same formula that we had before. N is equal to sum over I, the kinetic energy basically, over the negative of the potential. This is the equation that you get, right? But the Mach constraint, pi alpha equals pi naught equals p naught equals zero, is telling you that the total energy is constrained to be equal to zero. That's the Mach constraint theory. So here you get these constants of motion, but the free endpoint variation is just saying that constant of motion is zero. So, I want you to say that. Okay. That if we were to lift the Mach constraint, what would happen? So, if we were to just take the Mach constraint out of this, what we would find is that now the energy can be anything. And when we're trying to look for the total amount of time lapse, so if we're looking for n times d lambda, and you integrate that, we're going to get as an integral over t over minus v. And this thing is going to be constrained by boundary conditions because there's q's in here. So the point is that and on shell, these q naughts are related to the spatial variables are related to Q naughts. So what I'm trying to say is that if we lift the Mach constraint, this thing is fixed to be equal to something. It's fixed to be equal to the difference between the final value that you put for this and the initial value. So what we do is we fix boundary conditions. We say this is the amount of time that's elapsed. And this quantity would have to be equal to that. So in that case, the energy would have to be such that this is satisfying. So what I'm saying is that the energy would be fixed by these boundary conditions. And that's basically because we wouldn't have anything here. But the second that we have the Mach constraint, Now, this guy is constrained to be equal to 0, so we have to take him out of here. But the way that this is satisfied is because now we have this extra freedom to specify that. So that's the basic idea, is that the and then this is true, I think, also in the general case for best matching. What the best matching is doing is it's freeing you from the boundary conditions, basically. And then once you're free from the boundary conditions, your constants of motion are now these things that are set to 0 by this principle that we have. So And in the quantum theory, you get these sort of operator constraints, which in this case is saying that you have a time-independent theory.
So you have this arbitrary m0 there. So doesn't that, I mean, your E has to be equal to 0, but your E is not really your physical energy, because the physical energy should be related to time as not n, but n plus m0. So in fact, you still can get like an arbitrary constant energy. It doesn't have to be 0.
Well, I mean, if you actually work, if you work it out, what you see is that this gives you equations of motion that look like Newton's laws of constraint energy. That's all.
Yeah, and the constraint energy can be anything.
No, the energy is 0, right? Like if you, so that if you were to do this system, if you were to make a measurement on the system, what you would always find is energy is equal to 0, calculating energy. The point is that the energy that you calculate is based on your definition of time. So
exactly. And yeah, the thing is that your ephemeris time here, which would give a 0 energy, is not your real time, which is n plus m0.
Oh, right. But this thing is unobservable. That's the point. So this is the thing that's a sort of gauge-independent quantity that you can actually measure. But this thing, is not an observable thing. So it enters as the time in these equations, mm-hmm. but really it's not physically accessible to you.
Okay.
So anyways, I want to go through this because I think it's kind of a nice theory. And in general relativity, if you look at the analog of this, which we're going to do next time, you get the ADM action. And it's kind of interesting to ask yourself the question. See, in this theory, we can lift the Mach constraint, and we get time. We get an absolute time. So what does that mean if you do the same thing in general relativity, if you just sort of get rid of the Mach constraint? See, in general relativity, the people never talk about the Mach. They don't really, basically, you solve for the Mach constraint straight away. So to get the ADM action, you take this and plug it into here. And then you have the ADM action. So people don't typically think of the theory with these two constraints separately and what happened if I got rid of this. So it's kind of an interesting thing to sort of think about what happened if you try to lift this constraint in GR and you have a time-dependent or background-dependent version of general relativity, which is sort of essentially what we want, maybe for subsystems of the universe, for like local subsystems where we have time. So anyways, let's move on. Any questions about that? So what we're going to do now is talk about how to best match field theory. And I'm going to try to pick a kind of what I think is an intriguing example. Because it's the wave function of the best match particles, right? So the idea is that we're going to have a field defined on some manifold, and in this case, we'll just start with the case where the manifold has global Killing vectors. So here, our manifold is just going to be R3 to the power of the amount of particles that we have. So we're going to have some wave function defined on our absolute configuration space we had before. So this is now I'm not looking at this theory, I'm looking at the one with, I'm looking at, I'm going to make time absolute here. I'm just going to best match the spatial symmetries. And And the reason is because of time. It's complicated things that to deal with. Distraction point for view. So there's going to be a time variable, and there's going to be particle positions. And the wave function is just going to be, the wave function is just going to be some complex value field defined on this configuration space. But this configuration space has global killing vectors, so we can do rotations and translations on it. And so those are going to make it so that this field is invariant under diffeomorphisms in the direction of those particular symmetries. So what we're going to do is we're going to introduce auxiliary fields, the same way that we did before. But now the auxiliary fields are going to generate those diffeomorphisms.
So the theory is invariant under those rotations, but why would a particular like state be invariant, or is it?
Because I can define my wave function on this space here. Because the space-time is invariant under those particular rotations or translations, then it shouldn't change the theory, right? Like if the wave function is defined on the space-time, and the space-time has various symmetries, then the wave function is going to have those symmetries as well. Yeah, maybe I'm not saying.
Your underlying space is a configuration space.
Yes,
it's not space-time.
It's space-time, yeah, and times. So let me be more clear. I'm rotating the positions of all the particles the same. So I'm doing a rotation that will rotate the positions of all the particles. So if basically my rotation is not going to have an I. It's just going to have a vector.
It's going to be a collective representation.
You're doing like the best matching type thing.
I'm doing the best matching, but now it's a field defined on space-time. So what I'm doing is I'm kind of using the symmetries of the space-time
to rotate the whole field.
Yeah.
But you're not saying that the field itself has to be invariant under those symmetries. Those are two different things.
Well, okay. So what I'm saying is that the theory that you get at the end of the day is going to be invariant. The wave function is going to change under diffeomorphisms. Values of the wave function, points, but physically it's going to be indistinguishable from. I think that's what I'm saying. Not sure. Yeah,
we'll see.
The theory. The point is that the theory. I suppose what I should say is the theory should be there.
Yeah.
Under these different.
Another question. Can I think of the old best matching condition as arising out of this one? If I take my field and say just be a delta function.
Yes.
So I'm trying to have a geometric picture of what's going on. So now I don't imagine a triangle, say, in fact, three particles. Instead, I imagine a single point in a three-dimensional or nine-dimensional configuration space. And now I do the same translation for each of the three particles. And what's my best matching? Is there a geometric picture?
I haven't really thought. I mean, like, I suppose. What are you doing? Well, you're a point. If I have a wave function as a delta function on this configuration space, what that's saying is that, I have a bunch of particles in configuration space, right? So I have a system of. I do have a triangle still, right? So what I'm doing is I'm still rotating triangles. If I apply this diffeomorphism to that particular point, what it's going to do is it's going to do an active rotation of that particular point. It's going to move that point along in a rotation configuration space. And then what you would picture is you would picture a triangle now moving along. So this delta function would be represent a triangle. And you would go like this. This would maybe be a rotation. So this would be the triangle in this rotation. So really you are in this.
Okay, so I think the key for me, I just realized, is that if you have two different triangles, those are two different points.
Yes.
And the reason you can't necessarily make them match is because you have to do the same translation for all three particles. And so that means that the way you can move the configuration space is limited.
Yes.
So you could sort of, you know, consider moving this way, and then you get close to the second triangle, but never quite on top of it. And you have to figure out what is the set of translations and rotations that will take you as close as possible. So I don't know what the metric is on the configuration space, but there'll be some metric that corresponds to this sum of squares of distances, and you'll want to know what transformation gets.
Yeah, if you have so now you're talking about if you have two distinct points, not just doing a rotation. Now you're saying I'm taking two configurations and trying to solve for different.
Yeah.
That's slightly different question, but yeah. So then it's really the same thing. It's just that now you're applying the rotation to the entire. You have to remember that when you apply these auxiliary fields, that they have to apply sort of equally to each part. So a rotation is going to rotate the position of particle A, particle B, particle C, particle D, all the same. And so then you're sure that you're really rotating. So that, I guess it's the geometrical picture. It's mathematically, it's actually very straight. You can do this just with one particle, and then you can easily generalize to the case of two particles. And it's fairly clear to see what's going on, but I agree that it's good. So is that good? Alright. Now the action in the action is that I want to look at is a dt and a dq. And it's just going to be this action, where this guy is the operator, is an operator Hamiltonian. So I can even put a hat on it. It's just this guy, 1 over I, pi hat squared over 2 at y. This would be that. So it's just the quantized version of this guy. But then you can pick a basis where pi is just like this, so this should be I there, plus I. Then the q naughts are just q, or the q hats are just the q's, and then p hat is minus I divided by N. And then this, so then you can see that if you do a variation with respect to this guy, you get the Schrodinger equation. If you do a variation with respect to this guy, you get the complex conjugate of the Schrodinger equation. After you do integration by parts to set the operators in the other way. So,
Sean,
yes.
You have a p naught now, but you didn't have a q naught.
This should be. This is the guy conjugate to. So it's not a. It's just an operator. Maybe I should just write it. Not even minus I divided. I'm just defining the action. So I wanted to give the Schrodinger equation. So I constructed it in such a way that it will automatically give me the Schrodinger. Just to show that this theory is standard quantum mechanics for n particles. So a variation with respect to this guy, the action will give, and then a variation with respect to this guy, the action will give complex conjugate. And you can do integration by parts here. Yeah, the derivatives acting this way. So now the next step is to do the best matching. Okay, so this is the theory that I want to best match. And the way that I do it is the same way that we did it before. Remember, before we defined these corrected coordinates which were some group element times this. Now we have a wave, but we have a field. So we can't use exactly the same formulas, but it looks virtually identical. Because now what the symmetry is under diffeomorphisms in the direction of these multi-kilo vectors. So what we have is we have these corrected coordinates that look like the exponential of, now the group is just the diffeomorphism. So this is a Lie derivative in terms of these Kaling vector fields times wave function. So and here, the prescription that we had found was that what we do is we promote derivatives with respect to lambda to covariant derivatives, which are d by d lambda plus omega dot alpha. And this piece here is just the derivative of the elements of the local algebra. And so by analogy, you have the same description here, that you get derivatives with respect to t go to covariant derivatives, which have this piece that is the Lie derivative of the sort of time derivative of that piece. Okay. So that's the prescription. And all we need to do is figure out what those global Kaling vectors are, and then we can easily write down the action. It amounts to finding these guys. They're the global Kaling vectors. So what I'm just going to do is find the global Kaling vectors of R3. So you have x and Kaling on each element. So what's the definition of a Kaling vector? It's when you, the Lie derivative is supposed to kill the metric. So the Lie derivative of these guys kills the metric. The metric here is very simple. Lie derivative of a delta function is equal to zero. Because this is a tensor, it's two component tensor, the Lie derivative takes simple form. It looks like it's the directional derivative directional derivative of the delta function in terms of this. So it looks like this. And then you're supposed to add, basically now you just switch. You do it for this index and then you do it for this index. So we've got j, k, delta, I, k. And that's equal to zero. So really, once we collapse these indices here, you just get that. There should be another piece that's the derivative of the delta function, but that piece is obviously zero. So now this just turns into chi I of the vector field j is equal to minus j I. So basically this vector field, this tensor is anti-symmetric. So you're looking for fields that satisfy this equation.
Yes. For those of us who don't think much about metrics, can you explain why, in this case, the metric is this Kronecker delta?
Oh, because if I want to find a length in R3, an infinitesimal length, I use Pythagoras' theorem, which is just going to be so a metric. the distance between two points infinitesimally is going to be the metric times the increments in each direction. So in general, this could be, this is some matrix times two vectors. And in the case of R3, infinitesimal distance, you know, it's just dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And so,
yeah,
that's obviously going to be diagonal. Okay, so so we're looking for vector field to satisfy this equation. And there's, I'm just going to put ansatz in and show that indeed they satisfy that equation. But you can actually prove in general that there's only three Killing vectors, global Killing vectors, defined in R3, and they're the ones that we're going to. They're the ones that we're going to write down. So, the solutions. If you take a vector field that looks like A, which is a constant. So this means a constant on R3. So it can still be a function of time. Then it's pretty obvious that if you take the derivative of a constant, they're always going to be zero. So this is indeed a valid Killing vector field. But what does it mean for these Killing vectors to be constants? Well, what do my corrected coordinates look like? Well, they're the exponential of the Lie derivative. But with now with these a's, which are constants of this bound. But the Lie derivative is just a direction derivative in the direction of a. So this is the same thing as dx a dot grad I and sum over I. So now I'm kind of like, I found the Killing vectors of R3. Now I have to do this to every particle. So now I'm summing over I. And this is just going to be the shift operator. Right? So this is just going to be phi evaluated. If this was, if we started with, if this guy was phi evaluated at some point q, then this would be q minus a. So these guys are generating translations, right? They're generated diffeomorphisms morphisms that are just making this wave function value at a different point. So that's what that vector field is. And there's, the other solution is psi I is epsilon I j k omega j, which is a constant, but can in general depend on t, and then q. So this guy is a constant, and well, you can see that that's going to satisfy that relationship. If I take psi I of this guy, j, looks like a j, k, l, omega, k, q, l. And this guy acting on this guy is going to give a delta function, delta I, l. So then I turn l into I, and I get epsilon, j, k, I, as omega, k. Now, if I look at the other side of that equation, it's just w j, I just swap the indices. I, k, l, omega, k, l. And now the j turns into the L. So this looks like epsilon I k j omega k, which is these guys are the negatives of each other. This is, you just swap these two instances and they're kind of assigned. So indeed, this is a valid field. And you can prove that these are the only slips that you can get. Now,
why are there six?
Why are there six? Because basically,
how do you count that?
How do you do the counting? Yeah. Because what you want is you're looking for.
It should be clear to me that there are six fields of that sort.
Right? So somehow it reduces to the same problem as if you have a. You're looking for, this is the metric, or sorry, you have the metric of this.
So you've got three of those, the psi i's with the i's, right? Because I can be one of three values.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got three translations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why would you expect six?
No, I was just wanted to see.
Oh, okay, sorry, actually it should be. It should be the same amount of the generators as SM3. No, that's not right. As the it's the same as the Euclidean group. So if it was Minkowski space, you get the Minkowski. So you would get, in addition, you have time translations, and then you have this. So you have 10. And the way that you do the counting is, it winds up being locally the same thing as what is the group that's invariant. Under this, it turns out that the same amount of conductors you get, the same amount of basically generating this group. So that this is the same as three, but then you have to have the translations. I wanted just to show that these are actual rotations. Now, locally, you can see that. But these are the generators of the translation group, SO3. And so locally, these are just rotating the coordinates. And so that's also what happens to the corrected coordinates. You have some exponential of omega crossed with the q's. And this thing is dotted with this guy. So if you work this out, it winds up being equivalent to some rotation in this particular direction, in this rotation parameter times qr. So again, it's just shifting in the direction of rotation. That's kind of nice. It's basically saying that we have the same symmetries as the particles that were living in this configuration space. The next thing that I want to do is now just apply this corrected coordinate method. So use this prescription and work out the theory. That's not going to take long at all. So let's do that. Where am I? I'll remind you of the action. The action was just and it was this Hamiltonian here. And the Hamiltonian had a piece in it that looked like minus I divided by IT phi, and it was a phi. Star on the other side of it. So the Hamiltonian had a piece kind of like this. So the idea is that what we're going to do is we're going to replace this occurrence of the derivative with something that looks like this. And the Lie derivative is just a directional derivative because this thing is a scalar function. It's not a tensor. So the Lie derivative of that, this looks like the following. So we're going to have dt, dqi, and the fact that we still have this dt piece is going to mean that we're still going to have this piece. But now we're going to have an additional piece, minus I, phi bar, times the Lie derivative but it's the dot of these other fields. So the Lie derivative of it would be the direction of the coordinates. So maybe I skipped a step there, but you can see this is the piece that we look at again. It's just promoting this thing, this piece here. I take the this is the local algebra element, and now I'm just saying that local algebra element is going to be the covariance, so it's going to be the connection on my new space, but I'm going to take the derivative of it, the t derivative.
But you still have the t derivative, right? You didn't write it.
The dots are diagram.
No, but I'm saying you should still have a minus I di by t, which you didn't write.
Oh yeah, I put it, it's back in there.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, yeah. Right. And this is my new action. So now we do the same thing as we did before. We do a free endpoint variation of the auxiliary fields. Free endpoint variation of A and omega. I think it's good to do that one first. So if we take now we do a free endpoint variation. So that's the same thing as di s di a dot equals zero. Well, pretty easy to do because there's only one term that's linear a dot. So that's going to give minus I phi star sum over I of gradient I equals zero. For non-trivial theory, you need to have that sum over I is equal to zero. Now, what is this? Remember our momentum constraints from last time, that the total momentum had to be equal to zero. But if we promote this to a operator and we require that it acts on the wave function, this is just the quantization of this constraint. So this guy is just quantization this guy. Just kind of cool. You do the same thing for the translation, we expect things. Translations, we have di s and omega dot zero, which is going to be now when we do the variation of this guy, it's just going to move this piece into here, and we get sum over I. Dot So similar for a non-trivial theory, we need some over I. Zero. And our momentum constraint for this guy was that the sum of all angular momenta pi plus pi is zero. So for a particular operator order, we get quantization of this constraint. And you can change the if you change the operator order, it's equivalent to doing various integration by parts, different stages of the variation. So
So how does this work in a quantum setting? Because you have two constraints.
Okay. No, they do. They do commute. No, they're they're plus some brackets to zero. So they will commute. You have to check that, but we did that when we did and what we found is that they actually only commute. All the constraints only commute if we have these consistency conditions. So if you have global gauge invariance, they actually so for only for certain potentials will these constraints commute. And I guess that's the same here. The potential, if you just have an arbitrary potential, it's not going to be invariant under these elementary fields necessarily. So you need to have that the potentials are invariant under these. Then the original assumption is invalid. If you can do this, it doesn't change.
I'm surprised that the psi is not to the right of the q. Is the q not an operator in this context?
So that's why I said a particular operator order, right? So I could, when I promote these operators, there's an ambiguity of which one I have act first on the wave function. And I can pick an operator order and where I want this to go. I could, but because I can write this same constraint classically as minus q cross p, right, equal zero. It's the same constraint. And if I promote this to an operator, I have p. So there's an ambiguity, and this is sort of counterfeiting.
Either ordering, I would still expect psi to be on the right hand side of everything.
I guess it's just the way that I run it. Like if I put a minus sign, I can get the psi. If this is equal to.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah.
Minus. Actually, when I first did this, I was really worried about this. So it's kind of interesting that actually what we found is we have one more crucial function, which is the variation of the normal variation of the fields. But you can see that that's if we do a variation with respect to these guys, okay, we're going to get. So let me just do variation with respect to the complex conjugate. That's going to give h psi. And then we're going to have this new piece here, which is just this. But this is equal to zero because of the constraints. So once I impose the constraints, you can see that if I pull A doesn't depend on the I, so if I pull the A out, then this piece is going to be equal to zero. And if I pull the omega out, then I do a reshuffle of these using vector identities to sort of think of the dot I put it outside and the cross part inside A is zero. So this guy is zero. So really, I have a Schrodinger theory plus these extra constraints.
So when you didn't
before without the fields. You also had another constraint, the dilation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You don't have it here. Is this because you can't have it, or?
I suppose you could just do that. It's not going to be a global plane vector throughout the space time.
Yeah.
But it's somehow still going to be a symmetry in the theory, possibly. So you could do that too, and you could just write like instead of having this guy be a Killing vector, he could just be something that's generating a diffeomorphism that's going to be equivalent to this rescaling. So it would be something like the exponential of this particular thing acting on the function of it. Some spatial constant times. You can define some sort of vector field that's going to do this for you, and then do the same procedure. And I think I've done it actually, so you get the same constraint. But it's. So you can do it. I don't know if it's useful, it is. But, yeah, so I really wanted to go through this for a couple. I just want to make a couple of comments then. The first thing is that the constraints, the linear constraints in the field theory are now differential equations. So the first order, the constraints are, instead of being first order polynomials in the momentum, they're first order derivatives. So the first order differential equations. That's going to be true too in general. The second comment is that GR is basically exactly the same, except that instead of having some global Killing vector or some global field, globally defined thing, it's just an arbitrary vector. So here, basically, there are no, we want a space-time that doesn't have necessarily any Killing vectors, but only local Killing vectors. And so this thing, we have literally this with the metrics, three metrics here, and this guy is now an arbitrary vector field that's going to be dynamic. So now it's going to have a degree of freedom at every point in space. So GR just goes further. See, because the idea is what we've done is we've noticed that space-time has some symmetries. It's based on the way we define our theory on, provided we give a good potential. There is symmetries, and then we've gotten rid of them by imposing these constraints, essentially. But now, in general relativity, we want to go even further than that. We want it to be invariant under arbitrary changes of coordinates. And so, completely background independent. And that's where we're going to have these arbitrary changes. So, but you can see that the spirit is very similar. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, what we really did is you can take Newtonian mechanics, and then you can best match it. Then you get Barber-Bertoni theory. And then you can quantize Barber-Bertoni theory, and then you get this relational Schrödinger theory. Yes, relational Schrödinger theory. Or you can, what we did today was we quantized Newtonian mechanics, and then we had a Schrödinger theory. And then what we did is we applied best match. And we got the same thing. So the point is that if you go this way, it commutes with going this way. I don't know if the same would be true if we had quadratic constraints or something, but it's interesting that this diagram commutes.
The ordering ambiguities don't affect that.
Well, you have operator ordering ambiguities in both approaches. This approach, there's definitely an operator ordering ambiguity in the context here. The ambiguity that you get here is basically how many integration by parts do you want to do? Because the integration by parts are going to take the derivative and move them to the other guys. And so depending on when you do them and how you do them, you're going to get a different operator order. So but the idea that there's an analog of that problem in both of them. So yeah, obviously if you pick different operator order, and you might not get this. You won't get this. There is an operator order that will be consistent for each. So any questions? All right, so next week we're going to do general relativity. And the original plan was to have 7 lectures. This is the 7th lecture. So I think that it depends on how much interest there is. We can do, I'm not going to be here next week. I'm going to visit Julian, so there won't be anything next week. But the week after, we'll definitely have one, and I'll do general relativity. I think I can do give you the basic idea of GR in one lecture, just because it's so similar to focus theory and the particle models we're doing. But if you want more detail, we can do another one. It'll totally depend on how much interest there is. So, I guess we can decide after next week, or not next week, the week after. People want to hear more about GR or less. Because, I mean, for the GR stuff, you can go on forever because there's a lot of subtle things. But I think that basically after one lecture, it'll be enough that if you want to read the literature, you have a pretty good idea of what.